yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Sing the robber band. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, this week we want to talk about a number of topics here. Most importantly, the recent announcement by Trump of his new budget and what that budget means in the short term and what it also means long term for this accelerating U.S. national debt. And in general, we want to talk about total U.S. debt, which is far larger than even the national debt, and related topics. Okay, but before that, a few items, news of the week that are worth talking about here. One is Brexit. You know, that thing going on in the UK, where 2.5 years ago they voted to leave the European Union, and they're still talking and talking. Well, you know, that popular referendum, British people said leave, has been delayed. Why? Well, because business interests in the UK don't want to leave. And their whole strategy has been to kick the can down the road. They don't want a hard Brexit, as it's called, a no-deal Brexit. Just leave. But they can't agree on what terms for staying in. The European Union won't give them nice terms. And the British politicians want a better deal, but the European Union won't give it to them, because if the European Union give it to them, an easy deal, they're just signaling the rest of the European Union that y'all can leave, you know, and that would be a rush to the door, and the European Union would break up. So they're not inclined, the Germans and so forth aren't inclined to make it a sweet or even a fair deal for the British. They're going to make them pay the price. And the British don't want to pay the price, the British politicians. So they can't get their hard Brexit. They don't want a hard Brexit. They don't want a European deal. They're stuck in the middle. And they're just going to continue this way. They're going to continue kicking a can down the road until the population gets so fed up with it all, then they'll feed them another second referendum. That's been the strategy from the very beginning, you see. In the meantime, of course, the British economy begins to sink and deteriorate, which it has slowly, death by a thousand cuts here, particularly the finance sector. So they're choosing a slow assassination, self-assassination, as opposed to a quick exit and try to deal with that. Okay, so what we got is perpetual Brexit. That's what it is. And we can expect more of the same. They got more votes coming up, then another extension and so forth. It'll extend even further. Okay, another topic, a preliminary topic, before we talk about the Trump budget and deficits, is North Korea. Usually I don't go there on this pure foreign policy stuff, but, I've been talking a lot about the new role of the neocons in the U.S. and Trump and his administration. They're pretty much running the show, you know, guys like Bolton and Abrams and Lighthizer and Navarro and others. And I've been talking about it in relationship to the China-U.S. trade deal, which they're trying desperately to scuttle for some time now. And I've talked about it last week when we talked about, week before, financial imperialism, the case of Venezuela. Because the Boltons are behind that as well. So they're trying to scuttle U.S. trade. They're planning, in the driver's seat, planning this Venezuela invasion. They're behind the Iranian sanctions. That whole Iranian sanctions deal and the Venezuela deal should be viewed as a way, at least in part, to prop up global oil prices. In other words, the sanctions send a signal to the global oil futures speculators that, there may be a shortage of supply because of the sanctions. Therefore, the speculators drive up the price of oil. And that's great for U.S. shale oil producers. They love that, you see. So That allows them to keep pumping out more and more oil supply and keep the price up, which is a double benefit to them in terms of revenues and profits. But what about North Korea? Well, I think the neocons are behind trying to scuttle a North Korean negotiations. And Trump, of course, clearly shows he's not in the driver's seat. Trump went over there, and he thought he had a deal all ready to sign. And the North Koreans said to him, pretty much, it's leaked out in the first day. It's been covered up since. The North Koreans say that told them, apparently, reportedly, that, okay, we will dismantle missile sites and nuclear development at five sites if you lift five sanctions. In other words, show of good faith here. We'll move towards what you want, total denuclearization, if you move towards what we want, which is lifting the sanctions. Well, the U.S. refused to do that, and they pretty much sandbagged North Korean Kim there in negotiations. And now he's pissed off, and now he's turning to, redevelopment once again. And I think they're going to make a statement pretty soon, pretty much saying negotiations are dead. And of course, Trump comes back from that negotiations over there in Hanoi with North Korea with nothing in hand, an egg on his face, pretty much. But that's the signal for the neocons to start playing hardball again with North Korea. So we see, you know, the neocon influence in U.S. foreign policy, economic and non-economic, increasing here under Trump. It's probably behind the U.S. recent decisions as well to abrogate missile treaties with the Russians. It's also behind the U.S. Sending advanced arms to the Ukraine, and increased pressure by the U.S. on Germany to abandon its Nord Stream gas pipeline with Russia. So we see this offensive everywhere beginning to emerge, a new aggressive neocon. These are the guys who gave us Iraq, you know, Bolton, Abrams. These are the guys who got us into Iraq. And now they're getting us into the next one, two, three, who knows? Really dangerous. You know, the danger is not the U.S. military. It's these domestic ideologues. And they're far more aggressive and risk and adventurous than even the U.S. military is in many, many cases, although they have their friends there as well. You know, they're the guys who got us into Vietnam. Now we're seeing the same thing happened with Iraq. And now we're seeing the same thing happen again. The only difference is what's the location of the implosion here? Was it going to be North Korea? Is it going to be Venezuela? Is it going to be somewhere else? Is it going to be Ukraine? We don't know, but they're intent on that. So that's my comment on U.S. foreign policy in North Korea. Another point I want to make is about an unprecedented public appearance made by the Federal Reserve Central Bank Chairman Jerome Powell, who went on 60 Minute Show here a week ago. And why did he do that? That's unprecedented. That hasn't happened. That happened only once before with former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke in 2008, you know, in the midst of the crisis when he had to do everything to restore the confidence in the banking system and so forth. Why is Powell going on 60 Minutes here and talking about the Fed, with the central topic of which was Fed independence? You know, because it's pretty damn obvious that Trump has leaned on Trump and Mnuchin and others leaned on the Fed last December when the stock market was imploding 30-40%. Oil prices down 40%, looked like the early phase repeat of 2008 crisis. Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, calls in all the experts on Christmas Eve, you know, panic, panic. And Trump intensifies his criticism of the Fed having raised interest rates four times during the year. And of course, the rising interest rates were precipitating financial asset market contractions, and they were really worried about that. It was pretty serious there last November, December, not just the stock market crashing, but high-yield junk bonds for the first time ever. None were issued. None were issued because no one knew what the interest rates were really going to be, or the interest rates were too high, and businesses, corporations would not borrow junk bond and triple B and near junk bond at those rising rates. So they leaned on Trump. And, of course, Jerome Powell immediately after stops raising rates. Rates stopped at roughly 2.5% of the benchmark rate, which was less than half of what they were in 2007 when they peaked. Right. So quickly, business and political forces intervened with the Fed and said, stop raising rates. Now, the Fed always says, oh, you know what, our rate policy has nothing to do with financial markets. You know, BS. You know, I mean, it's a double smoking gun here. And in January, of course, the Fed stopped raising rates. And what's happened since then is that we have continuing pressure on the Fed by Trump and business banking interests to not only not raise rates anymore, but to lower them. Yes, growing pressure to actually start lowering rates. As I said years ago in articles, the banking system and investors are addicted to low rates. They're addicted now. They can't and don't want rates ever to rise. You know? They want that cheap money, because the cheap money can be turned into profits. And that's what we got going on now. So why did Powell go on 60 Minutes? Well, he's trying to do two things. One, to reestablish the myth that he's independent of the government. The central bank is independent. And he's pushing back on Trump's anticipated future pressure to actually lower rates. So that was a kind of an important development there. If folks are interested in my analysis of this whole Trump-Powell thing, I recently published an article in the European Financial Review called Trump versus Powell, How Independent Really is the Fed? And folks are welcome to go to my blog starting later today and read that article, Trump versus Powell. How independent is the Fed? And I go into more detail on how business banking interests have always called the shots strategically, the shifts in Fed policy, and how in this case it appears that Trump is putting the pressure, but the pressure was put by finance and banks and investors on Trump and the administration. And then, of course, the politicians do the bidding. So who's really intervening and undermining central bank independence? Is it the politicians or is it the private capitalists behind the politicians? Okay. Enough for that particular topic. One other comment here on last week. Beto O'Rourke, you know, the darling of the progressive Democrat center-left, is now in the race for president, along with 12 others. I've said all along, I think there's a policy here or a strategy here by the Democratic leadership to flood the candidacy here for the Democratic nomination with all these candidates in order to undermine and split the vote in these primaries coming up of Bernie Sanders. Split the vote, you see. And therefore have a, you know, maybe one of the others will, you know, progressives will catch fire instead of Bernie by stealing his program, you know, Warren or somebody. Or if not, then if they're all split on the left of the Democratic Party, in steps Joe Biden and picks one of them for vice president, and then Biden gets the nomination. That's a likely scenario. But who is this guy, O'Rourke, you know, is a question I think we should ask ourselves. He came within 3 percentage points of upsetting Ted Cruz in the Senate elections there in Texas in 2016. And, you know, he talks the progressive talk when he's campaigning. But what's his real background is a question here. Well, you know, now they're beginning to reveal some of his background. And one thing that has me worried is that this guy has voted repeatedly while in the House his first term to cut back benefits for Social Security. Yeah. How progressive is that? I wonder, right? And a few other votes which will be coming out here, I'm sure will show, well, you know, he's maybe not that progressive. And what's also coming out is that, you know, he got into the House of Representatives with big backing from Texas millionaires, billionaires, which makes me suspect right away, right? He's beginning to look like a white Barack Obama to me. You know, Obama got picked out after one term in the Senate, one term in the Illinois State Legislature, and one term in the U.S. Senate, gets picked by the billionaire interests in Chicago, the Pritzkers and so forth, family there, owners of big hotel chains and conglomerates and so forth, and they push him forward and finance him, and of course he gets the nomination. Well, I don't know, are the Texas oil and billionaires attempting maybe to repeat history here with their white Barack Obama? I don't know. Let's keep an eye on that guy and find out what's behind it. But, you know, I wouldn't rule that out, particularly given some of his financial backing already and given, you know, some of his early votes, which aren't progressive at all. You know, in my book, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, published in 2012, I go into quite detail here. We're with Obama to show who backed him. And, of course, he talked the talk when he was running and even went to the left of Hillary, stole her thunder, adopted the program of John Edwards. But as soon as he won and got the nomination, as soon as he won, of course, he filled his administration with bankers. You know, the old establishment, the old Clinton establishment and bankers. You know, that's the game they play when they think there's a crisis coming. They, meaning U.S. capitalists, they play that game. They'll back a progressive horse or have him run as a progressive, but he's really not a progressive. So let's keep an eye on that fellow and keep an eye on the neocons who are doing their dirty work increasingly everywhere. And also on what's going on with the Federal Reserve monetary policy and the attack on Fed policy. Okay, that's the preliminary. Let's turn to the main topic of today's show, which is the Trump budget revealed on March 12th, I think it was. Well, very interesting, not surprising, but very interesting. Some of the provisions in that, right? What were some of the proposals? Well, $2.7 trillion in cuts to social programs over the next decade. $2.7 trillion. Medicare reduced by $846 billion. Social Security and Social Security Disability Insurance by $26 billion. Food stamps, housing, aid, Medicaid, $327 billion, student loans, $200 billion, and other discretionary spending on education, federal worker pensions, EPA, and other government departments, $1.1 trillion. So a total of $2.7 trillion in cuts and a roughly equivalent increase in spending on military, homeland security, border walls, $15 billion roughly in border walls, and other political favorite programs like school vouchers and veterans and Homeland Security, etc. Okay, so what is this? This is a big shift he's proposing to shift trillions of dollars from social programs to defense and war spending. Yeah. Okay. That's not new, is it? They always had a strategy since Reagan of starve the beast, create these big budget deficits. And what is the deficit? Today, it's already $22.5 trillion. $22.5 trillion. The U.S. national debt. Because we are now looking at, and have been, starting this past year, a $1 trillion federal national government deficit. $1 trillion. Okay, the CBO reports just under $1 trillion. But, you know, there are certain things that don't show up in the published written budget, like military black off-budget new weapon systems developments, which are at least $50 billion a year is spent on that. That doesn't show up anywhere. And the public never gets to see how much or what for. Only 8 people in Congress are privy to that, and they got to keep their mouth shut. You know, when you add that $50 to $75 billion, you're over $1 trillion last year. And the projections are, even by the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, that we're going to have $1 trillion-plus deficits for every year from between now and 2028, $1 trillion or more if we have a recession. Yeah, because recession means that your tax revenues fall off, and therefore your deficit rises, and therefore your national debt will rise with it. Each deficit. Okay, so $22.5 trillion in the national debt right now, and $1 trillion deficits for far as the eye can see that are coming. A special advisory committee to the U.S. Treasury Department, you know, of private experts and so forth, forewarned the Treasury here a couple of weeks ago, expect that you're going to have to sell $12 trillion more in bonds because of the deficits. $12 trillion. That's how you cover the deficit. You sell bonds, either to foreigners or you sell them to U.S. Investors, right? Now, the foreigners are buying less and less of the U.S. bonds. China and so forth are reducing their purchase of bonds. The total debt of held by foreigners used to be in the mid 40% of the U.S. total debt. Now, latest I've seen is down to 36%. So are the foreigners going to buy this stuff more and more? Not if we keep whacking on the head with trade wars. Yeah. Or sanctions, right? But the U.S. thinks they'll keep buying that stuff. Well, no, they're going to have to get U.S. Investors to buy it, which means they're going to have to raise interest rates on the bonds in order to elicit more purchases of those bonds. Ah, but they can't raise interest rates now because Trump and the bankers don't want them to raise interest rates, them meaning the Federal Reserve. So it's a catch-22, you see. They got to raise interest rates and bond rates, treasury bond rates, interest rates, same, in order to fund this $1 trillion-a-year deficit going forward. But they're stymied from raising those rates for political reasons and for economic reasons as well, because rising rates above 2.75 for the benchmark treasury rate precipitates financial market contractions, you see. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. They got to fund the debt. But when they raise rates to fund the debt, what happens? Oh, the financial bubbles begin to burst. We'll see where that goes. Very interesting. Anyway, so that's $34 trillion by 2028 in just the national debt we can expect. $22.5 trillion now, another $12 trillion, that's $34 trillion. That's a lot. Yeah, it's so much that the Congressional Budget Office has estimated that what it means is that we're going to have $900 billion of just interest payments on the national debt by 2028, $900 billion. Actually, if we have a recession, which absolutely we will have sooner rather than later, it's going to be more than $1 trillion. $1 trillion a year, paid to whom? Who gets the $1 trillion? Everyone who bought bonds and bills and notes from the Treasury. Well, who are they? The wealthy investors, the 1%. Corporations that buy bonds and bills and so forth. Banks that buy Treasury bonds. I don't know too many people like you and I who buy Treasury bonds, although you could if you wanted to. But those are the folks who get that huge interest on the debt. Well, that much increase in interest income accruing to the wealthy and their institutions, the corporations, right, is going to exacerbate income inequality even further in the U.S., right? Even further. Expect that to continue to happen. So we've got this, $34 trillion in total national debt, U.S. national debt, which is on the horizon here, right? That's not the total picture, folks. Well, before we talk about the total picture, how does this $22.5 trillion go into $34 compare to recent years? Well, in 2000, when Bush came into office, total national debt in the U.S. was $5.6 trillion. When he left office, it was $10 trillion. So it almost doubled under George W. Bush. Why? Because of massive tax cuts of $4 trillion, most of which went to investors and the wealthy, $4 trillion, and at least $3 trillion in additional war spending because of Iraq and Afghanistan and wars in the Middle East. So under Bush, we get about $7 trillion in excess spending on war and tax cuts that translates into the debt, the national debt, which goes roughly from $5 trillion to roughly $10 trillion, doubles. Well, Obama comes in and it doubles again. When he leaves office in 2016, it's $19.5 trillion. So it almost doubles under Obama. Obama, too, plays the same let's give tax cuts for the rich game and let's increase spending on war and so forth in national security. About the same amount, $6-7 trillion. Well, where does that come from? Well, look at Obama's tax policy. Comes into office 2009, recovery program, $300 billion. Quickly extends the Bush tax cuts that were supposed to expire in 2010, extends them for 2 years, cost of $450 billion a year to extend the Bush tax cuts. That's another $900 billion. The U.S. economy falters. The recovery begins to falter because his program was not sufficient for recovery. Recovered the banks, but not the rest of us. It was slow go. And, he passes another $806 billion in corporate tax cuts and wealthy tax cuts. So $300 billion, $806 billion, $900 billion. And then he agrees with Congress to cut social program spending by $1.5 trillion in August 2011. They were supposed to cut defense spending, but they kept kicking that can down the road until it finally disappeared, and they never cut defense spending, you see. And then in December of 2012, right after he gets reelected, he agrees with the Republicans to extend the Bush tax cuts for another decade at a cost of $5 trillion. So we got Obama playing the same game on tax cutting that George W. Bush played. And then Trump comes into office. He's running for office. He promises another $5 trillion in tax cuts for corporations and the rich. And, of course, he passes that at the end of December 2017. Right? He continues escalating defense and war spending, not so much now for Afghanistan, and certainly not so much for Iraq, but some still. Okay, but now, the spending is going into new technologies, it's going into a new space force, it's going into new nuclear tactical weapons, right? And new Navy ship development. Oh, this is all about the Pacific, you see. This is all about the U.S. finally pivoting with expenditures promised under Obama, but now being implemented under Trump, turning towards China, right, and turning towards Asia. That's the next while they simultaneously clean up their backyard in Latin America. See, that's what they're doing, and simultaneously put pressure on the Europeans to pay more of the cost of keeping Russia in check. Okay, so that's the game being played that is causing the $100 billion a year increase in defense spending under Trump. You know, the Pentagon budget and Trump's budget here, latest, is $750 billion just for the Pentagon. Now, that's not the total defense spending, you see. Because on top of that, whatever we spend for foreign wars, that falls under the category of overseas contingency operations, OCOs, and who knows what that's going to be. On top of that, the veterans' benefits aren't in the Pentagon budget. That's in the Veterans Affairs, and that's part of defense spending. That's going up. The Atomic Energy Agency, which bears the cost of nuclear arms development. That's going up for tactical nuclear arms. The Energy Department, U.S. Energy Department, bears the cost of all the fuel used by the military. That's going up. Other costs as the CIA and the NSA and even the State Department increase their civilian special forces. You know, they got their own armies, right? CIA does, mercenaries that they use, their version of special forces. That spending's going up. You add it all up, the total spending on defense in the U.S. is at least $1 trillion, at least. Okay. Now, you'll hear the argument, the budget deficit is going up because of social program spending. Not true. Social Security is financed out of separate tax and has a surplus. Yes, Part D of Medicare is going up and SSDI is going up under Medicare. But Part D is going up because we never passed the tax for prescription drugs for seniors, you see. It was always planned since Bush in 2005 and its inception to be financed out of the deficit. And of course, as the pharmaceutical companies gouge everybody, including the government, those costs are going up and up, right? So, Part D, prescription drugs, that social spending cost is going up. Social Security disability is going up because more and more people are figuring out how I can get lifetime unemployment benefits instead of just 6 months by maneuvering within the SSDI and claiming a long-term disability. You know, we've had a million new SSDI participants since 2008 in the crisis. You know, so SSDI is going up, and Part D prescription drugs are going up, and Medicare in general is being squeezed because of rising costs by insurance companies and the whole healthcare industry, especially profit hospitals and so forth. That's going up, but that still is not in a deficit. And Social Security retirement is not in the deficit. What about education and some of the other programs? They've been cut ever since 2011, when Obama agreed to take back twice as much as he gave in government spending, twice as much as he set out in government spending in 2009, take it all back in 2011, which they did to the tune of $1.5 trillion. You know, so that $1.5 trillion has offset any of the minimal increases due to price gouging that has occurred in social spending since 2011. So social spending programs are not the problem, you see. They're either financed independently outside the budget, Social Security, or to the extent that they are, they're still offset by that $1.5 trillion cuts that have already occurred. The big culprits are obviously the defense run-up, $1 trillion total bill we have now for that going higher by at least $100 billion a year every year. And the big tax cuts. Tax cuts count for 60% of the budget deficits, or taxes do, tax revenues. And tax cutting, of course, massive tax cutting, as I've pointed out, far more under Trump here than just the official $1.5 trillion, you know, at least double, triple that. And now we're getting, the big bite of the tax hikes on the middle class. Now they're occurring this year, and they're beginning to see that their refunds are gone that they used to get, and now they're paying out of pocket. Well, you're paying out of pocket, and it's going into the pockets of a big business. They're the ones who have had their tax revenues reduced by $300-500 billion here just in 1 year. Okay, so that gives us the deficit, and these cumulative deficits every year raise the national debt. But the national debt is not the total debt. It's just the national government debt. What about state and local government debt? What about corporate debt, non-corporate debt, household debt, government agencies debt, central bank debt? Well, what is that? What does that amount to? Well, state and local government debt's over $3 trillion today, going up. Household debt, $13.5 trillion, going up very fast, particularly for credit cards and student loans and auto debt and so forth. Corporate debt, corporate bond debt, how much is that? Oh, over $9 trillion, maybe $10 trillion. Non-business commercial and industrial loan debt, more. Federal Reserve Central Bank debt, $4 trillion, and the bank, Central Bank has decided it's not going to try to get rid of that debt, which means it's going to add more of it. Government special agencies, like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, more debt. If you added up all these other non-national government elements of debt in the U.S., you would have somewhere between $30-35 trillion more right now. You see, the total U.S. debt right now is somewhere between $50-55 trillion. And it's going up. The $12 trillion I mentioned going up for the national debt and all these other categories from households to corporations, so forth, debt going up as well. You know, by 2028, we could easily have $70, $80 billion in total debt in the U.S. Now, as I've said many times before, you know, just the magnitude of debt is not the real problem. The real problem is when you build up all this debt and then you have a recession or a financial crisis and prices fall and sales fall, which means both drive revenue lower, which means lower revenue means lower profits and lower cash flow in order to pay the principal and the interest on that huge debt run-up. That's when you see the crisis, when they cannot pay that principal and interest that comes due. And when you can't pay, you default. And when you default, well, then the prices and the value of your company collapses even further. And then your real debt rises even more in terms of what you really have to pay with what you got, you see? This is called the Fisher effect, based on an economist, Irving Fisher, right? Real debt rises because when there's a recession, you know, your ability to pay the debt collapses, falls, prices fall, whatever. But the debt doesn't decline. The debt stays the same. So the ratio of the debt to your ability to pay for it gets worse. And when you can't pay for it anymore, then you just declare bankruptcy, default. Right? And that affects business in general when big companies default. Watch General Electric, right? In deep trouble. You know, used to be a blue chip company, in deep trouble now. They've even just forewarned that expect another 20-25% drop in their profits over the coming coming year. It's going to break up at some point if the trend continues. And let's talk about corporations, corporate debt. You know, it's not just the magnitude of the corporate debt, but it's the quality of the debt that's important, too. What do I mean by quality, right? Whether the debt has a high interest on it, and what are the other terms and conditions related to the payments of the debt? You know, the debt could have easy terms and conditions. In other words, the debt agreement can read that, if you can't make principal and interest, the lender will roll over the debt and reissue it again at the same rate. But if the terms and conditions aren't very favorable, you could have language that says, the lender will not roll over this debt anymore, in which case the company has no alternative except to go bankrupt, and the lender will go and take its assets and sell them and recoup some of their credit that they had loaned out. Right? Well, let's look at corporate debt in the U.S. Let's look at corporate debt. Very interesting. As I've been saying, the next recession, the centerpiece will not be real estate property price collapse. It will be corporations, non-financial corporations in particular, that are going to be in deep trouble here. Now, you can divide corporate debt, bond debt at least, into several categories. One is investment grade, and it's less likely that it will collapse. And in other words, that less likely that company will be able to pay its principal and interest. You know, maybe they have a good cash hoard on hand, and they can continue even when their revenues fall to keep paying principal and interest and not default as a result. You know, that's called investment grade debt, corporate debt. That doesn't default. But junk bond debt, meaning the company is a zombie company and it's been loaned more and more money to pay the past principal and interest, which it couldn't pay in order to keep it afloat when it should have really gone under or merged with somebody. We have a lot of zombies out there, a lot of zombie corporations. That's called junk or high yield debt. And even intermediate between investment grade and the junk debt is what's called the triple B rating debt. Triple B, which is really junk debt too, right? Well, if you look at triple investment grade bonds out there, and a proportion of its triple B rated debt, triple B was $700 billion in 2007. Today, triple B is $2.7 trillion. $2.7 trillion. Of corporate bond debt. That's huge, right? 10% of companies in the U.S. stock market a couple decades ago were triple B rated. Okay, today, half, 50% are triple B rated. So the problem with these companies, if they can't pay this triple B and junk bond debt, which is more junk is added to this, is not only going to have an impact on the bond markets, it's going to have an impact on the stock markets as well. They're going to both go south together. Okay. But what if this debt doesn't come due for some time? Well, that puts it off. But the problem is one-third or $1 trillion of this triple B poor grade corporate bond debt is coming due in the next couple years. $1 trillion. They got to refinance $1 trillion. If there's a recession between now and 2021, that's going to be difficult, right? And that could precipitate a wave of corporate bond defaults, corporations that are triple B or junk bond related. So we'll keep an eye on that. But that's one of the Achilles heels here of the bond debt that we have. It's a real problem, and even business interest have begun to recognize that and warn about that. As one, report in the Financial Times here this past week, to quote one source, Jim Smigel, I guess, is his name, head of the strategy at SEI Investment, one of these hedge funds, says that, quote, credit is the canary in the coal mine. It tends to lead equities toward the end of the cycle. Now, part of the problem also is if these companies had accumulated sufficient cash reserves, they could weather the contraction coming. But what have they been doing? Well, they've been buying back their stock, without hesitation. Last year, corporations spent $800 billion in the U.S. to buy back their stock. $800 billion. Then they gave out another $500-some billion in dividend payouts. This is cash they could have had in an emergency, but they've been divvying it up, you see, to their shareholders. $1.3 trillion in stock buybacks, dividend payouts, which means they're going to be short of cash, especially these zombie companies, junk bond and triple B companies, going to be short of cash when the contraction comes. And will the banks roll over their $1 trillion of debt coming? I don't think so, or certainly not all of it or enough of it, right? So we've never seen the corporate sector, which with so much low-grade corporate debt on its hands, right? And part of that fragility means, financial fragility means they're not able to weather the storm, and they're not able to make their payments, and they're fragile, right? And they could contract and go out of business real quick. Financial fragility, which was the theme of my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Fragility is like a precursor to financial instability. It's like you're prone, increasingly sensitive, increasingly prone to financial asset price deflation and crash. Okay. You know, the problem is not just the United States, of course. We have this the whole capitalist global system's running on debt like it never did before. And the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, has been repeatedly raising the red flag on this problem globally, and pointing out that since the last crisis, the debt, global debt, has not been reduced. It's actually risen by 50%, 50% higher. The total debt is even greater than it was before, which tells you that, the whole system is running on debt. Consumer households are running on debt. Corporations increasingly running on debt, poor quality debt. The government debt is rising as well. Everywhere, all the major sectors, debt. China total debt, 250% of GDP, roughly the same for Japan, 200% for Italy and places in Europe, U.S. about 100%. So we have, this growing dependency of global capitalism on debt. Now, as I said, you can keep running up the debt as long as you don't have a major contraction, a business cycle contraction, a recession, or a financial recession, meaning financial asset markets collapse. And usually if you have a financial correction crash, it drags in the real side of the economy and vice versa. So you have both cycles, financial cycles, business cycles, real cycles, converging when one or the other begins to contract. And they have very little reserves, i.e. cash, because they've been plowing it back into their investors and their shareholders. And of course, they're unprepared increasingingly. But all that plow back over $1 trillion a year here this past year, and $1 trillion a year for the last 6 years in the U.S. alone, that's why we have so much income inequality. We've boosted these capital incomes, so outrageously, and that that has caused the gap in the distribution of income between owners of capital incomes and non-capital incomes, say. And that's the major reason why we have so much income inequality that continues to rise. I'm not saying that the lack of wage growth has and minimum wages and so forth has not contributed. Yes, it has. But even more so, we've been boosting the high end while we've been stagnating or reducing the non-capital low end of the income distribution in this country and in the world. You know, it's not just a U.S. phenomenon. It's really a global phenomenon that's going on, and it shows you how the global capitalist economy is running on credit and debt. How far can that go? Who knows? Who knows? We don't know for sure, but certainly when we have another contraction, financial or real, we're going to see some new dimensions of the problem reappear here, and it may make 2008-09 pale by comparison. Who knows? You know, we'll just have to wait and see. But certainly the next contraction, monetary policy, the Federal Reserve, is virtually dead in the water in the U.S. and globally. The U.S. has not been able to raise its interest rates very high so that it could lower it to stimulate recovery next time around. And the Europeans and the Japanese can't do it at all, you see. They have not only not raised their rates, government rates, they've actually lowered them into negative territory, negative rates. They have no more ammunition over there. That's why they resort to quantitative easing. In other words, other ways other than interest rates to pump money liquidity into the goal, into their economies, you see. And they're developing other tools as well now, like bail-ins, in order to, in the next contraction, to try to goose up the failing economy with more free money. We'll see how far that goes. So, you know, monetary policy is kind of dead in the water, or it's not very effective anymore. You know, even in China, it used to take a $1 of stimulus, monetary stimulus, to generate $1 to $1.5 of GDP growth. Now it takes $4 of stimulus to generate $1 of GDP growth. That's why the Chinese, in their latest stimulus, are not relying on monetary stimulus as much and trying to turn towards tax cutting and so forth. But look at the tax side, fiscal policy side, right? Have we also reached a limit in our ability to stimulate the economy with taxation? It's beginning to look like that too, right? Well, look at the Trump tax cuts here. Hundreds of billions of dollars, I don't know, $300 to $500 billion last year. How much real investment did we get out of it? Real investment means, you know, development in the structures, commercial and residential, and in equipment spending and so forth. Well, if you look throughout all of last year in the U.S., those categories have declined. Commercial construction has been declining. Residential construction is declining. Retail sales, a big drop at the end of last year, haven't recovered. As a result, inflation is slowing. Both consumer and producer prices are slowing. Autos are dead in the water. Housing construction, housing sales, new sales, and sales of existing homes, both down, even into 2019, both down. So construction and manufacturing are hurting, and all that's holding the economy up is services and government defense spending. And, of course, services always respond last to these developments in the real side of the economy and manufacturing and construction, which are now turning down quite obviously. And they will, services will soon follow over 2019, I believe. And the only thing going is government war spending and defense spending, just holding it up, barely. That's why I predict we're going to have a recession early as later this year, but certainly in 2020, but could come even earlier here. And at the same time, we have global trade growth slowing dramatically. China is slowing, even now admitting, its growth is less than it has been. And some say it's at least 2 percentage points less, in the 4% range, not the 6% range. So China is slowing. Europe, including Germany, is slowing dramatically. And now we got Brexit for the UK. And we have economies around the world, emerging markets, still languishing in recessions. It's not a scenario for recovery here. And that's why I argue we're looking at a recession late this year, early the following year. And when that happens, all this problem with bonds, particularly in the corporate sector, the non-financial corporate sector, are going to raise their ugly head here. And should we start getting defaults of companies, like GE or Penney's, JCPenney's, or Macy's, or some of the others, quite obvious in the oil patch or whatever, that's going to send a psychological contagion across the board, and it's going to cause businesses to pull in even more so than they have. Well, look, 22% of the 27% profits registered by the S&P 500 corporations in the U.S. last year, 22% was due to the windfall from the Trump tax cuts. In other words, the profit rate would have been somewhere in single digits if it wasn't for the free handout that Trump gave businesses last year. That covered up, the problems that really exist out there in the business side of the economy. Now, those tax cuts continue year after year, but not as generously as they did in the first year. So we're going to see a slowing of corporate earnings here as the impact of the Trump tax cuts is less and less. Conversely, we're going to see an increase in the impact as the tax hikes began on the middle class this year and continuing and really accelerate after 2022, Okay. So, that's the scenario that the U.S. economy is facing right now. And it's not a pretty scenario. And it's within a context, I believe, of a global situation where there are no signs, no lights at the end of the tunnel anywhere in the global economy. In the U.S., the lights are flickering, And they may go out, within the next 12 to 18 months as well. But yet, Trump is proposing to shift trillions of dollars, from households, non-corporate, non-business, to corporate and business, to the tune of tens of trillions of dollars. Well, this budget is dead on arrival, of course, in the House of Representatives, but it is a shot across the bow, a warning that if Trump is in trouble, he's going to blame the Democrats for not passing his budget in the election year of 2020. Or he may pull a national emergency action, just like he did on a smaller scale for his wall. He may say, okay, you won't approve my budget. I'm going to implement it myself anyway, and I'm going to transfer that money from the rest of us to the military and to defense. And if the neocons get their way, there will be a conflict to justify it, either in Latin America or in Korea or somewhere else. Okay, so that's the report for today. Check out my blog, jackerasmus.com, for articles clarifying this deficit debt and Trump versus Powell in the Fed, or my website, jackerasmus.com. Okay. That's it. I'm sure this whole thing is going to continue to bubble and be a lot to talk about next show. That's it for today. Jack Rasmus, Alternavision.